You're listening to the Sex and Psychology Podcast, the sex ed you never got in school and won't get anywhere else. I am your host, Dr. Justin Lay Miller. I am a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute and author of the book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Sexual and romantic relationships have changed a lot over the years. In the not-too-distant past, most people followed the same model and settled down into monogamous marriages pretty early on in life. Today, however, people are spending more and more of their adult lives single, fewer are opting to marry at all, and those who do are waiting much longer to tie the knot. In today's show, we're going to delve into the modern sexual landscape and look at what people really want from their relationships, how they feel about the rise of casual sex, and what attitudes toward monogamy, non-monogamy, and infidelity look like. We have some really interesting things to discuss, including why marriages today, though fewer in number, are actually stronger than ever. We're also going to dive into a fascinating paradox about modern hookup culture, which is that most people say they'd prefer to date than to hook up, but most people think that everyone else just wants to hook up and not date. If most people would really rather be dating, then why do we assume that no one else wants to? And why is it so hard to find a date? I am joined once again by Tina Fetner, a professor of sociology at McMaster University. She is the author of the new book, Sex in Canada, The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North. She is also the former president of the Canadian Sociological Association. This is going to be another fascinating conversation. Stick around and we're going to jump in right after the break. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. If you had some extra time in your day, how would you spend it? A lot of us wish we had more time to do the things that we really want to do, whether that's getting some exercise, reading a good book, or spending time with a friend. However, when we finally have some time in our schedules, we often don't even end up doing these things because we haven't made our own pleasure in life a priority. It's time for that to change. We need to get clarity on what we want for ourselves and learn to prioritize the things that are important to us in our schedules. Therapy can help you to find what matters to you and help you find more ways to do it. BetterHelp can connect you with a licensed therapist who can give you the tools you need that will empower you to become the best version of you. Therapy can help you to develop positive coping skills, learn how to establish boundaries, and navigate life on your own terms. If you're thinking about giving therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's 100% online, super convenient, and flexible to fit your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist, but you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Learn to make time for what makes you happy with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/sexandpsych today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/sexandpsych. If you love the science of sex as much as I do, consider becoming a friend of the Kinsey Institute at Indiana University. The Kinsey Institute is the world's premier research organization on sex and relationships, and you can help them continue the legacy of Dr. Alfred Kinsey, whose pioneering research changed everything we think we know about sex. Visit kinseyinstitute.org to make an impact. Your donations can help support ongoing research projects on critical topics. You can also show your support by following Kinsey Institute on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Thank you for supporting Sex Science. Okay, Tina, let's talk about commitment, casual sex, and cheating. So basically, we're going to be talking about all of the ways in which sexual and romantic relationships are changing. Let's start with marriage. It wasn't that long ago that basically everybody got married. And statistically, you would be kind of an anomaly if you were an adult who was living single and had never married. So based on your research, how has the rate of marriage changed over time?
Well, this is such an interesting question, and demographers have been tracking this. And so the rates of marriage are going down over time. And when we hear that, some parts of our culture have really worried about that, wrung their hands about, oh, what's happening? It's the death of marriage. It's going away. And it's important to know it's not going away. Just because it's decreasing from almost everybody to not almost everybody, there's still a lot of people who get married. But one of the things that's interesting about Canada is that you know, there are differences across the population of who is more likely to get married and who is less likely to get married. So French-speaking Canadians and Canadians, you know, who are concentrated in the province of Quebec are much less likely to get married than English-speaking Canadians. And so this is just a unique cultural difference that is up here and that is being led by French-speaking Canadians.
And it's kind of just like what's happening in France, right? Where, you know, rates of marriage have gone way down there and there's been a rise in civil partnerships, right? So yeah, we're seeing that trend and, you know, you see it within certain countries in certain areas, but you're also seeing it elsewhere around the world where some places marriage seems to have fallen out of favor much more so than others.
Yeah, that's right. And I think some of it is cultural and then some of it is related to kind of policies at the local level of like, you know, benefits that married couples have access to that common law partners are blocked out of or vice versa. And so I think some of it is because of people's personal core values and cultural differences, but some of it is just practical.
If I remember correctly, I read a stat in your book about how it used to be, you know, in the 1960s or so, that around 90% of women in Canada were getting married, and now it's about 51%, right? So it's still a majority, just a slight majority, but, you know, that is a pretty sizable shift in a short period of time.
I would point to social norms here. There were very harsh negative consequences in the past for women who did not get married. And so we have, you know, stereotypes and names like spinster. And they were, you know, at a time when it was difficult for women to enter the labor market or to retain ownership of property or to get credit, the stakes were much higher for them. And there was a lot more pressure to get married. And so the policy changes that we made to support independent women, I think, are positive. And the one of the consequences is sometimes they just choose not to get married.
Yeah. So gender equality is definitely playing a big role in terms of why women are often choosing not to get married or are waiting much longer to get married. It's because they don't need marriage in the way that they used to in the past, because women have a lot more economic freedom and independence and the ability to chart their own course when it comes to their lives, relationships, jobs, and so forth. But are there other reasons why people are just deciding not to get married or are delaying it longer? So is this also reflecting a change in just sort of the general perceived importance of marriage? Is there some disillusionment with marriage where maybe with so many people having seen their parents get divorced that they don't want to go through that themselves? What do you think?
I think it is a mix. I think it's everybody knows it's a very complex personal decision, but it's related to complex social, you know, structures. And so the same kinds of things that we're talking about in terms of women's access to the labor market, we have learned since the 1970s when divorce rates increased that there are very serious financial consequences to divorce. And so when people have a choice to get married or not, if they've seen their parents go through periods of low income or have to struggle because of a divorce, you know, maybe not getting married in the first place, or maybe having a partnership or even a marriage where you keep your finances separate, those kinds of arrangements are growing over time. And the other thing that is growing in the last few decades is just singledom, mm-hmm. right? So part of the story of the decline in marriage is people living together and not getting married, right? Might call it cohabitation. Up here, we have a term common law marriage, which is basically like marriage law applies to you, even if you're not married. And so you may think you're getting out of it, but actually you're still kind of subject to the same laws that married couples are. But you're more likely to live alone as a single person. And this is a kind of unique social status that did not exist for many people in the past. And very similar to whether you're a man or a woman, the idea that you would just rent an apartment or buy a house or have a household just on your own was kind of unheard of. And now it's quite common.
Yeah. You know, common law marriage is a term that for some of my listeners might be completely new to them. And it does exist in the US, but only in a few states. And basically the idea behind it is that you have two people who are living together historically, this would be a man and a woman who would be living together and who were unmarried. And after a certain amount of time, the state would just automatically categorize you as being married. It's like, well, you didn't do it, but we're going to treat you as married because we think everybody should be married, right? So that's kind of like what the idea of common law marriage was. It was like a marriage by default if you had just lived together with somebody long enough. It's kind of fallen out of favor here in the U.S. It does still exist in some places, but yeah, it's an interesting piece of marriage history.
Well, up here in Canada, it's not history at all. It's one of the ways that the state, you know, is very involved in all of our lives. And sometimes we can pretend it's not. But in fact, it doesn't matter up here if we get married or not, depending on the province. Like, so I'll speak to Ontario where I live. Like, it doesn't, if you live with somebody that you are having sex with, and sex is the defining characteristic, if you're having sex with a partner and you live together for a year or more, all the marriage laws still apply to you. Wow. And so you can carry your finances however you want. If that relationship dissolves and one partner wants access to half of your, you know, material wealth, that they legally can do that.
Yeah. So basically you would still go through divorce, even though you hadn't gotten married. Technically.
That's right. So marriage applies to more of us than we think.
Yeah. Interesting. Especially going back to what we talked about in the previous episode, with lots of people thinking that Canada's more liberal in a lot of ways. But, you know, at any rate, so we've talked about how the marriage rate has gone down, but so has the divorce rate. And you write in your book that marriages have actually become more stable over time. So while fewer people are getting married, the ones who are getting married actually seem to have stronger marriages. Why is that?
You can answer that question better than me as a psychologist, right? But I think that, you know, the sort of social structures that prevented people from like living together before they were married, or that prevented people from feeling comfortable having sex before they got married, kind of pushed people, nudged people in the direction of marrying sooner with partners that they knew less well than under the conditions of the current moment, where you can have sex with somebody, you can move in with somebody, you can really get to know if you're compatible before you take a step like marriage. And you know, a lot of people do that. And so marriages where you cohabitate before you get married are much more likely to stay, or that dissolve less frequently, I should say, than people who move in together at the point when they get married. And so I do think that it is just kind of life experience that gets you to the point where you know this is the partner that's going to be for you.
Yeah, I think other ways to think about this are that there's probably a selection effect. You know, the people who choose to get married are maybe ones who have a different attitude toward it. Maybe they do see marriage as being more of a lifelong kind of institution. And so maybe they're more likely to stay married for that reason. Maybe it's only the people who really want to get married are actually doing it. Maybe they're waiting longer and they're making sure it's the right thing to do without feeling socially pressured into it. So yeah, there could be a lot that's going on there. Now, you mentioned that people today are kind of living in this period of extended singledom. You know, they're spending more of their adult lives not being in marriages or long-term relationships. And that has coincided with a rise in casual sex. So as we're spending more time outside of long-term relationships, more of the sex we're having is in that kind of casual context. But there's something interesting in your data when it comes to casual sex and hookups, which is that most singles say that they'd rather be dating than hooking up, but most singles seem to think that everybody else just wants to hook up. So in other words, there's kind of this weird disconnect. You know, most singles say they want to be in a relationship, but they think nobody else wants to be in a relationship. So what's going on there? I mean, if singles want relationships, why does everybody seem to think that they don't want them?
It's a complicated scene out there. You know, it's a good time to be an older person. My university students, you know, share their experiences on the dating scene with me, and it is very difficult to navigate. So one of the things that sociologists have articulated, I think, fairly well with the concept of hookup culture is that hookup culture is not about that there being something new, like as if one night stands didn't happen before the 90s or the aughts or whatever. Of course they happened. And now they still happen. And maybe they happen more frequently, but that's not what it matters to understanding that for young people today, for young adults, the dating scene is a hookup culture. What we mean by that is that the dominant rules of the game are that it's a hookup by default, and that if you want something different from that, you have to negotiate it, right? And so it really does matter that the majority of young people think that other people are just looking for a hookup. This tells us what the norm is, and that the majority of people don't want that themselves tells us that, well, the rules of the game aren't necessarily just a product of people's earnest desires, right? That there are some social forces at work here that are maintaining this hookup culture, even though that it's not serving the majority of young people.
Yeah. You know, my social psychologist side is coming out and thinking about how this is in part like a perceptual issue. And I think, you know, a lot of people who find themselves enmeshed in this hookup culture, they're assuming that everybody else wants to hook up and they're projecting that belief onto them. And then it sort of becomes this self-fulfilling prophecy where they end up treating that person like they didn't want anything more than just sex. And so it doesn't really have a chance to go anywhere beyond that. And even though both of you might actually want relationships, you're both treating each other like you just want sex. And then that's sort of what it becomes. So it's an interesting, complicated story here about the norms and then the perceptions and then how that leads us to treat other people. And then yeah, it's all a self-fulfilling prophecy.
I 100% agree with you. And I think that's really insightful. And I would add a layer on of gender inequality, right? Because I think that for heterosexual young adults, there is an imperative for heterosexual men to carry on with this sensibility that they're supposed to score, they're supposed to have high numbers in terms of how many hookups they have, they're supposed to not feel connected to the women that they have sex with. And for women, there's a mixed message where they're partly told that they're supposed to look for romance and they're supposed to look for emotional connection, but they're also told that they're supposed to support the desires of men, and they're supposed to follow the lead of the men that they're engaging with. And so they're torn. And I think men are similarly torn, though their messages are less mixed, and that those kind of gender imperatives get in the way of people finding their way to really fulfilling sexual experiences.
Yeah. Now, something else that I thought was really interesting in your data is that most people say they want an exclusive or monogamous relationship, but a large number of them seem to be afraid to tell a partner that. In fact, among people under age 30 in your sample, a majority of them said that they would be worried about asking a partner for exclusivity because they were afraid it would make them seem, quote unquote, needy. So what's going on there? You know, why do young people in particular seem to be increasingly worried about telling a partner that they want to be exclusive?
Yeah. Sociologist in the US, Lisa Wade, she says that you don't want to catch feelings, mm-hmm. like as if it's a contagion to feel connected to somebody.
And it's the worst disease you can catch of all. Yes. Feelings.
So, you know, and if you reflect back on all of your experiences and your connections, it's hard not to catch feelings for somebody that you're physically touching, that you're feeling a spark for, or that you're physically attracted to. And so, you know, I think it's really challenging for men and women to avoid catching feelings. And I think it's also tied up in this social dynamic where we are staying single for a much longer period in our young adulthood. And I think that one of the things I'd like to make sure we talk about is the way that, you know, we're having our sexual encounters and interactions in social structures. And the kinds of social structures that, say, gay men have worked to build and craft and create to create sexual cultures that are expansive and, you know, that are less tied to monogamy and have created spaces that clarify this sex is physical sex. It's not relation. This sex is relationship state, you know, kind, and we are exploring our feelings for each other. And the messages in communities of gay men seem to be clearer, mostly because they're not contaminated with the kind of shame and stigma, because gay men have fought for these separate spaces from the shame and stigma that the dominant culture has had. But in heterosexual culture, they're having those same kinds of expectations of like, oh, we're having commitment-free sex and that's what the rules of the game are, whatever, without building those structures, without that clarity of communication, and especially without resolving the issues of shame. And so I think it's just a much messier situation for young people to navigate through their way to where they can have sex that is enjoyable, that leads to a relationship if they want it, that doesn't if they don't want it, and find their way to those spaces.
Yeah. Now, it's interesting. I've heard a lot of sex educators and researchers who point to the gay male community and say, you know, they got it figured out when it comes to sex, and they can have uncommitted, uncomplicated sex. And like, let's look at what they're doing and what we can learn from them. And then when I talk to gay men, they're like, yeah, like sex is easy and great and I can have it as much as I want, but I want a relationship. How the hell does that happen, right? And so it sort of feels like there's kind of this grass is always greener phenomenon going on, where you've got a lot of heterosexual people who look at the gays and they're like, why can't we have sex like them? And then you got the gays who are like, how do we have relationships? Because everybody just seems to want to have sex, right? And, you know, gay men, it's a very complicated world when it comes to relationships, because there are some gay men who want monogamy. And then when they come out and say that that's what they want, they get judged or shamed for that, right? But then you also have gay men who say that they want to be non-monogamous, and then they get judged and shamed for that too. And it's like, you can't win in this world, because your sexual and relationship choices are constantly being judged, even in this supposedly sex positive LGBTQ community. I don't know, just my take on it. It's an interesting world.
It is. And so we ask about monogamy and sexual identity. And so we do find that there are more open relationships among gay men than among straight couples, and that lesbian women fall in between, right? More open relationships than straights, who have very few, but not as many. I think it was 19 or 20% of gay men who were in a relationship said it was open, right? So that's different than the whole gay community that's not in relationships. But yeah, among relationships, still most gay men are in monogamous relationships. Yeah. A pretty big majority are, but there's just greater space to have open relationships. And, you know, there's also a very weird gender dynamic happening among straight identified people, where it was, I think, a little bit over 5% of men said that they were in an open relationship, but like about 1.5% of women said that they were in open relationships.
Yeah.
What is that about?
Interesting.
Very. It's a very interesting question. I feel when I talk about gay men's social structures, some of it is like physical structures, you know, like bathhouses or like physical spaces where non-relationship based sex can occur. And it's clear to everyone, if you go in there, that's what you're looking for, right? And so there are fewer spaces like that for heterosexuals. And there's the amount of shame around those places, I think, varies, although it's not absent from any of those spaces, I think. But like, I think you're right. I think that the power that monogamy has to organize the lives of people in general is much stronger in straight community than in gay communities. And so I can see that happening. And it probably feels like pressure to some people, and it feels like comfortable and a nice, warm, you know, cozy, like hug of monogamy, and for others. And so, yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah. So I have one more topic I want to chat about here, which is infidelity. So, you know, going back to what you said, you know, it's interesting, like 5% of men say they're in some type of open relationship, only 1% of women. That suggests that for some people, there's like a disagreement about what their relationship structure is. And maybe some people are labeling it open when it's not really open and they're just committing infidelity to try and absolve themselves of personal responsibility. But, you know, that's a whole other story. But I want to talk a little bit about sort of what the prevalence of cheating in general is. So what did you find in your work in terms of how many people say they've cheated before or been involved in a relationship where cheating happened?
This is so interesting to me. And of course, it's one of the hardest things to find out when you're doing research, because to ask people about highly stigmatizing behavior, it's very difficult to have a sense of how many people are answering your question honestly. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so glad that our survey was an anonymous online survey. You know, I mean, to the extent that you have any control over how people are truthful on your survey, you know, you give them the space to be private and you don't identify them. And then, you know, you hope for the best. But so we did ask. We asked if your relationship was monogamous. We asked if it was open. And we had this third category of supposedly monogamous, which was that the rules were monogamy, but somebody cheated. And so people said yes to this category when either, you know, they were confessing that they had cheated themselves, or they were communicating that they were aware of their partner having sex outside the relationship. That was about 10% of the people in the relationship had this supposedly monogamous category. And so what do you make of that? One of the lessons that I take from that is that, well, these people are still in these relationships, right? And so the cultural narrative that we have that one single act of infidelity ruins our relationship and that's the end of it, spells the end, clearly is not the case. You know, that might be the case for some relationships, but that there are relationships that weather the infidelity or that manage the infidelity or that, you know, just carry on despite it. And this is supported by other scholars that dig into this question. I want to recommend a book by Alicia Walker called The Secret Life of the Cheating Wife. And she interviewed a lot of women who were, you know, seeking sexual experiences outside of there and has some really beautiful narratives of stories of people who really care about their relationships, but also want to have good sex.
Yeah. So I'm curious, do you have any sense as to whether infidelity is something that has changed over time? You know, there are some media reports that suggest that infidelity is on the rise, and these media reports often point to the internet as being the reason for a dramatic rise in cheating behaviors because it just makes it so much easier than ever before to do it. So curious to hear your take on that. Do we know, are people cheating more, and is it because they can go online now?
I don't know. Let me just say, I don't know. But can I ask you, do you think that we're cheating more now than in the era of Mad Men when, like, you know, women stayed at home and men went off to have their very public lives and their work lives and had so much more power and economic control over the household and a lack of surveillance? It's hard for me to believe that we're cheating more now. That divorce is more likely and that we have more, you know, variety and that there's more, you know, cultural space to take care of your sexual needs in a way. I doubt it, but I don't have the data to support me.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true that we have more ways we can cheat now and more opportunities to do it because the internet can connect us to other partners. You can even go to websites that will specifically be designed to facilitate you having an affair. But is it different from how it was in the past? And I think if you think about some of these previous historical periods, you could easily make the argument that cheating actually would have been a lot easier back then. It might have been more normative because, you know, in that very patriarchal world, men and women kind of lived these very separate lives during the day. And there would have been more opportunities to cheat, I think, on both ends, you know, for a woman at home with the milkman or mailman or whatever, right? And the man who's out at the office, like, could have all these other opportunities as well. And it would be much less likely to make its way back to the other person because there wasn't that level of surveillance that there is today. So I think it's still an interesting open question, and we just won't know the answer because we don't know what the rate of cheating was historically, because it was so heavily stigmatized in a time when marriage was just held up as the ideal for everyone. Monogamous marriage, I should say.
I am very curious and interested in thinking about the different kinds of ways that that impacts people's thinking about infidelity and cheating. Because if you are, you know, kind of locked in a marriage for life because there's no way to get a divorce, and, you know, the social stigma on getting a divorce is so high, it's a different calculation of whether you should have an affair, as opposed to today, where there's kind of like, well, you can end a relationship if you think that's the right thing for you. But also there's kind of a, I don't know, deeper pressure to have integrity and be honest. You know, you're likelier to get found out. And, you know, you also kind of owe your partner your presence and your a more sort of immediate kind of emotional nurturing than perhaps was required of husbands and wives back in the 50s.
Yeah. You know, and I think the definition of cheating is probably the biggest thing that's changed over time. And what it means to cheat today is very different from what it was in the past, because you have a lot of people today who now consider viewing online porn to be a form of cheating, or talking to an ex on Facebook, right? So what does it even mean to cheat or commit infidelity? That's a whole other podcast discussion right there.
If you figure it out, let me know.
Yeah, will do. Well, thank you so much for this amazing conversation, Tina. It was a pleasure to have you here. Can you please tell my listeners where they can go to learn more about you and your work and get a copy of your new book?
You can get it at any massive online bookstore or your local independently owned bookstore. It's is a labor of love. I really am delighted to share it with the world. It is called Sex in Canada: The Who, Why, When, and How of Getting Down Up North.
Love it. Well, thank you again so much for your time. I really appreciate having you here.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To keep up with new episodes of this podcast, visit my website, Sex and Psychology, at sexandpsychology.com, or subscribe on your favorite platform, where I hope you'll take a moment to rate and review the show. You can also follow me on the socials for daily sex research updates. I'm on Twitter and TikTok at Justin Lehmiller and Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller. Also, be sure to check out my book, Tell Me What You Want. And if you have a question you'd like me to answer on a future episode of this show, you can leave me a podcast voicemail at speakpipe.com/sexandpsychology. Thanks again for listening. Until next time.